Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hello and welcome from the incredibly cool MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA, where for the next hour or so, we are going to explore the impact of the internet on society with one of its great architects, Joey Ito. Joey housed Japan's first internet server in the bathroom of his Tokyo apartment. And in the years since, he's played a pioneering role in the development of online chat, digital advertising, social network software, weblogs, wikis, and many other marvels besides. He's a founding investor in dozens of internet companies, including Flickr, Six Apart, Last.fm, and Twitter. His success and influence has led him to become an ultimate example of the Interneterati, chairing Creative Commons and sitting on the boards of online foundations such as Witness and Global Voices, and directing the Media Lab here at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Joey is a passionate defender of the open internet in its current form and a firm believer in its benefit to humanity, claiming it's changing our lives for the better and spreading democracy worldwide. But is he right? Do we owe him a debt of gratitude? Or, after piracy, privacy infringements, and Twitter mobs, something rather different? We and our Boston partners at WBUR want to reach beyond Joey's ardent followers on Twitter. So do you, the BBC World Service global audience, think the internet is a benefit to society? We'd love to hear what you think about the internet and democracy in the first half of this programme. Then we'll tackle economic issues later. Get in touch via Facebook at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay or on Twitter at @BBC_WHYS, and we'll try to get your points to Joey Ito. Meanwhile, here is Joey about to take to the stage and outline his vision of what the internet will do for democracy.
Thank you. 9 years ago, I wrote a paper called Emergent Democracy, and it was a mostly optimistic paper. And if you remember 9 years ago, this was when blogs were really kind of emerging. It was before Twitter was a thing. It was before Facebook was a thing. But the paper kind of was looking at how we were having conversations online. And many of us, I was just repeating a lot of some of the conversations online, felt that there was a big shift in the way that we were going to be engaging, were going to be engaging with government. And the idea was that as people began to have voice, the ability to say what you want online, to speak up without having to invest in professional media or to be an authority, that somehow that creating this voice would fundamentally change the nature of democracy. It was basically optimistic, and the main point, which I continue to believe, is that in a world where people didn't have voice, didn't have the ability to talk to each other, you read mainstream media, which was really the fundamental pillar of democracy, which is to explain to the world what's going on in power, what's going on in the world. And the people would then read the media, come up with a view, and they would vote. And so it was kind of a way to inform people and then try to get their opinions through this very blunt instrument, which is voting. But what if everyone could talk, everyone could speak, everyone could deliberate, and everyone could actually become journalists? Would you actually need to ask their opinion through only votes? What if the world could get up and tell the government what they felt like? And so it was a fundamental change in the way we think of civics, because civics, the way that people engage with government, is really this very kind of blunt way without, it's almost like it's a nearly conscious thing that you're probing and poking with these devices. Well, what if it woke up and could speak back to the government? Wouldn't the world change? Wouldn't it be better? So one of the ideas was, how does social media become part of the enabling tool for citizens to be much more engaged in government? So that was one section of the conversation. I continue to believe this is something that we're working on. The other part, which I thought was very important, was I remember talking to a very well-known magazine editor and asked him, actually I think it was Ethan Zuckerman who asked him this question, why don't you cover Africa more? And he said, because people don't want to read about Africa. And fundamentally, if you're running professional media, even if it's nonprofit media like the BBC, you kind of care about what your ratings are and things like that. And you have this reinforcement of trying to produce content that people care about. And so I call this a caring problem. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what you know if you don't care. And how you fix the caring problem is you connect people together. So Global Voices, which I no longer on the board, but was a founding board member of, was this meeting that we had at Harvard where we had bloggers from all over the world get together, and everybody said we want to have a voice. And one of the key things of that idea was that if everyone had a voice and they could hear each other speak, maybe that would bridge the caring gap. Because reading an article by a professional reporter writing from Congo about the conflicts, you're still talking to that Western journalist. But if you hear a voice from Congo and become friends with the person from Congo, maybe you would care. So the other part about this social media and giving people voice was the idea that maybe people would care about each other. So those were sort of the optimistic parts. There were some questions that I had, like you mentioned privacy, I think, is a fundamental problem that we have to grapple with. But I think a lot of the things that we were talking about during that period are coming true. So, I mean, we all know some of the great things that have happened. I mean, obviously there's some issues, but if you look at Tunisia or the whole Arab Spring, Tahrir Square, one thing we didn't get exactly right was the important relationship between mainstream media, activism, and social media. So if you look at Tahrir Square as a specific example, you will see that the people in the square, there's actually, I was talking to Wada Kamfar, who ran Al Jazeera, and he remembers when the people from the square, as he was about to shut his team down for the night, called and said, "Don't turn off your cameras, otherwise they will kill us." And when they shut down Al Jazeera, everybody rallied against the government for shutting it down. And when the government put up fake tweets, Al Jazeera outed those fake tweets. And it's this relationship that was very important. But I think that the Arab Spring is a great example of how social media and the internet is able now to take down bad forces. There's another question. Well, can we rebuild governments?
And let's take a seat, Joey. Okay. Let's talk about, because you've said a lot in there.
Yeah.
So let's try and unpack a little bit of what you've set out. I'm intrigued to hear you talk about voting mm-hmm. as being quite a blunt instrument. Now you spoke to world leaders at Davos this year, and you encouraged them to call on the communicative power of the internet and use their citizens as a brains trust. Politicians, we know, they're interested in many things, but primarily they're interested in staying in power. And they can only do that if they can persuade people to vote for them. If you see voting as a blunt instrument, how do you think, what did you say to these people about using the populace, using their constituents as a brains trust? What did you mean by that?
So there are a couple of, at least two very good examples. One, which is a small example, but an interesting test, is the country of Iceland is now crowdsourcing its constitution, asking people what they think, pulling the information and putting everything out there and then bringing the citizens' voice in. It's a small country, it's a small sample size, but it's a first step in a government actually trying to listen to its people. I think the SOPA PIPA thing, which is an American thing, it was a bill that was trying to pass that dealt with copyright. And there was always this fundamental idea that you have to follow the money. You had to have power, money, to have political power. Well, people on the internet rallied against it so strongly that the politicians flipped the vote and voted for the internet rather than for their traditional lobbyists and constituencies. So those are two very good examples of how politics has been affected by the collective action. And then I guess the last one would be the crowdsourcing and the crowdfunding. President Obama has been very good at it, but raising much smaller amounts of money from a broader audience, which is also, I think, fundamentally changing the nature of politics.
So to those who don't know what crowdsourcing is, in a minute or less than a minute, tell us what it is.
So crowdsourcing is really trying to go to the crowd, the masses, asking everyone to contribute ideas. And the idea is that the crowds are smarter than a small number of experts. Crowdfunding is, again, instead of asking the 1% for all of your money, it's to ask for small numbers of like $5 each or $50 each from a large number of people. And it's much more so-called democratic than what we have today.
Okay, well let's look at this whole notion of bringing people together. You gave us some examples there in your talk about how if you know somebody from the Congo, if you've made a connection with somebody personally, that it's possible for you to engage with them in a different way than if you were just reading about them in a newspaper story. But there isn't there a valid example of the internet actually polarizing communities, that it actually becomes much more divisive because people tend to gravitate towards those who think exactly like them.
Yes, absolutely there is that tendency. And I think that there are First of all, there's fundamental human nature, and there's good old-fashioned racism that'll always be around and things like that. So the internet isn't going to fix human nature. It will sometimes amplify human nature. But I think what we need to do is to develop literacies, develop new forms of social media and other things to try to counteract that. Because one of the really fascinating things is that I think we're very, very early in the cycle. If you think about how many years it took for the printing press to actually impact the structure of government, we actually need to fundamentally change our cognitive models before we realize the value of the internet. And so I think we're very early days. And right now what's happening, I think we're actually going to see a valley before it gets better. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
And okay, so we're demanding too much of it at the moment,
I think so, yeah.
Well, this notion of, let's just take Twitter for an example, 140 characters to say whatever it is that you want to say, it can... When you talked about how important it was for people to have the ability and the capacity to just talk to each other, it can just end up sounding like a lot of chatter and actually just banal.
Yeah, and I think the trick is to, first of all, filter that out. But let's use this as an example. I think a lot of people here in Boston are tweeting, and they're sending people to the BBC page who have never been to the BBC. And after Twitter, I have probably hit more weird media sites in weird countries than I would ever have consumed if I had been reading my local newspaper in the coffee with my coffee every morning. And so I think there's an opportunity for an explosion of diversity. And I think we see both of those things happening right now.
Okay, we have four Twitter ambassadors here in the auditorium who are going to relay your tweets from the hashtag at BBC underscore WHYS throughout the programme. And I'm going to go to our first Twitter ambassador, Soha Bayoumi from Egypt now. She's a professor of political philosophy at Harvard, just down the road from where we are here. Soha, Joey was talking there about the Arab Spring. And we've heard so much about the Egypt revolution in particular being the Facebook revolution. Was it?
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you, Joey and Razia. Well, was it a Twitter revolution or a Facebook revolution? It was not a Twitter revolution or a Facebook revolution. I think many of the revolutionaries and the activists in Egypt would take issue with that, because they would certainly admit that Twitter and Facebook had a major role to play in the communications, dissemination of information, and facilitating mobilization. But the actual fights took place in the streets. People were really facing, as Joey said, you know, the fighting was taking place in Tahrir Square. The people were facing bullets and tanks, but they relied on the media in order to make their voices heard in bigger ways and in better ways, more efficient ways, and to mobilize. And of course, the government realized that, and that's why the government shut down the internet and cell phone coverage for a few days. So, of course, that was acknowledged even by the government, even by the bad forces that were supposed to be removed in that revolution. So I certainly agree, but it's important to put things in perspective too. And there are several tweets that, of course, echo that concern.
Is that ones you're getting just now? So share those with us.
There's Hussein who says that the internet enables political activists to practice their freedom without being persecuted by their dictatorial governments. That's one take on that. Of course, you know, it depends on the government. It depends on the particular situation. But that's a specific tweet here. And of course, one other important element is that social media in Egypt, let's take the example of Egypt, social media, even before the revolution in 2011, people have been using it as alternative means of communication that defy the traditional media that is highly censored.
Okay, well, I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to come back to you. The point that Soha makes is very interesting. You know, the activists wanted it to be known that they were out there protesting. There is something quite interesting going on here, isn't there? And we've seen it in Italy as well, in Beppe Grillo's mobilizing of 25% of the vote in the Italian election recently. That social media is fantastic for mobilizing, but not so great for organizing when it comes to after whatever it is that you've managed to mobilize. You know, that Griot's movement doesn't necessarily have solid policies, and it's much more difficult to talk about, to organize the civic society that you are talking about.
And I think, so again, I don't think that Twitter or Facebook were originally designed to create and run governments. And what's very interesting is if you look at, for instance, Code for America, and for instance, I just went and visited them in Philadelphia, and they're working with the local government. So there's a general, what we call the open government initiatives in the UK and in the US, where governments are trying to show their data, make themselves more accessible. What Code for America does is they send these nerds and geeks and programmers in there to work with the local governments to try to engage citizens. And they use social media, but they create all of this new software that's then given away for free for the rest of the world. So we have all of these labs all over the world where progressive governments are trying to figure out new tools to engage citizens, to inform citizens, to connect with journalists. And it's very interesting to see how the civic action and the media are kind of merging into a very similar function. And the key thing also about social media is, unlike traditional media, you're allowed to have a point of view, and there's a citizen behind it in many cases. And so I think that these new petri dishes, which are mostly smaller governments, like local municipalities and states, I think there's a lot of experimentation going on there that will do a lot more of the construction and the operations.
Well, let's look at this in slightly more detail in the context of China, because in China, there are more internet users there than there are citizens in the United States. How are those people able to use social media to in somehow effect slightly more political reform than they have at the moment?
So it's interesting because if you look at China, there are Chinese equivalents of Twitter and of a lot of the social media that we have here. A lot of the websites like the New York Times are currently blocked in China. But what's happening is they are allowing citizens to speak up much more than they did in the past.
So Weibo is the most commonly used.
Yes, for instance, Weibo. And I think that if you talk to the local people there, they probably don't have as much freedom, obviously, as they would like. But the index is increasing, comparatively speaking. And so I think the outside pressure is causing a little bit of reform now. We'll see where that goes.
But the reason why I brought up China there is because you were talking about the kind of the difference between localized mobilizing and, mm-hmm. and mobilizing on a state level. Because in China, it seems that there is, even if there isn't encouragement, there is at least some tolerance of social media use to agitate for going against people who are corrupt on a local level. Mm-hmm. Whereas the second you start to talk about political reform, democracy, mm-hmm. then on a national level, then that's completely clamped down on.
Yes, and
so in a way, it's the states. It's the center that's the power that's using the social media in that way.
Yeah, and in many ways, I think that the Arab Spring stopped at Syria, right? So in Syria, they had seen the others fall. They had a sophisticated government. One of my best friends, Basil Saddafi, this is just his 1 year anniversary of being in jail. But they, took his asked for his Facebook password, and he's he's a very important figure, and he's in jail, and they were able to clamp down. And so with sufficient warning and sufficient sophistication, governments can still stifle. And I think that this is a key point earlier, was that it's not just the social media. You have to have a very organized and active group of people. You also have to have the mainstream media. I think all three of these have to be very functional and quite coordinated for things to happen.
Well, let me ask you about what the internet amounts to for a huge majority of the world who uses it. It's a distraction. And, you've said that it's a pillar of democracy for the 21st century. On the World Have Your Say Facebook page, Steve Corran posted, pillar of democracy, perhaps, but pillar of narcissism, certainly. And David Cross made the same point to us slightly more succinctly. Most people seem to use the internet to find and share cat pictures. Mm-hmm. I mean, you do not see in large part, the internet is a distraction from the serious affairs that
like,
clearly it has been used
like
for
TV
as
comedy.
Well. Yeah, absolutely.
But so there are two things that I would say. You can almost directly correlate the drop-off in watching of TV with the increase in watching of playing with internet. So which I would say, even if you're a narcissist, being actively interactive is going to be moving your brain a lot more than watching, American Idol. Secondly, what I'll say is this is a very interesting thing, that there was a study last year that showed for the first time since they've started recording it, American youth interest in free speech increased. And they attribute this, some people, that to the fact that schools are clamping down on Facebook. And the kids say, well, I want to be able to use Facebook. So that may be a stupid reason to start thinking about freedom of speech, but if that causes them to start thinking about freedom of speech, that's a good thing. And so to me, you may start out sharing cat pictures and doing narcissistic things, but as you start to explore, you will stumble on things, because I think it's, my sister coined this phrase, hanging out, messing around, geeking out. And it first starts with a social circle. Say, hey, what are you doing there? Hey, can I try? Hey, I got interested in it. And a lot of it starts with somewhat social behavior. That's not going to happen sitting down watching TV, but that may happen if you're on Facebook.
Okay, so what you, it goes back to what you were talking about, a kind of cognitive shift in the way in which we think about the, using the internet. Let's see if anyone, we've got a few hundred people in the audience here at MIT Media Lab. Who in the auditorium would like to put a point to Joey on spreading the ideas of democracy? Please put your hand up and wait for a microphone to come your way. And tell us who you are.
Hello, I'm Alexander Armani. I'm from Cambridge Regional Arts School, about a mile away. And my question is, what is your opinion on the hacktivist group Anonymous?
That's a good question. So I think that they're very important because they show...
For those people who don't know, just tell us who they are.
Well, it's we don't know.
No, but you need to say that.
But it's really a group of activists, computer hackers, who do all kinds of things in a political way, shutting down websites, attacking things, and so on. And I would say this also broadly. I would put WikiLeaks sort of in that same camp of activist hackers who have a political agenda. I think it's important because, one, it shows kind of where the limits are. You can go after them, but it's now a feature of our world. And I don't judge them as so to me, the way that I think about the way that our literacy and the internet is going to become robust, it's kind of like a child and their immune system. If you protect a child from ever getting sick, that child will become a very fragile adult. But you catch the flu and you overcome it, you eat dirt, you fall, you hurt yourself, and you learn. And by the time you become an adult, you're relatively robust. You may maybe need your flu shots, but that's about it. So what Anonymous and what WikiLeaks, all these things are like catching the flu. It smacks us around, it hurts us, but what we do is we start to learn, oh, if WikiLeaks may steal all of my data, I better become what I call transparency robust. Because someday, what I write may show up on the front page of the New York Times. You used to say that all the time. Well, it happened. And so now people are going to be careful about it. And transparency robustness is not a bad thing, because it means that you better run your organization so that if someday it becomes completely open by hackers, you're not going to be embarrassed. And so it's a flip side of literacy. You have to start changing your behavior as if you may always get hacked. And so for me, having those people come out today, well, we're still, not everything is online, because in the future, you know, it's going to become much more dangerous. Yep. And we're going to have to develop an immune system.
Okay, let's hear from our Chinese ambassador in the audience, Freeman Zhang, originally from mainland China, but now living in Boston. Tell us what you've been reading, or tell us what you think about what Joey Ito has been saying.
I think basically his idea is right, but they have a very important assumption that the information on the internet, on the social media, is exchanged freely. Okay, because actually, if not, sometimes it cannot be a foundation for democracy. Sometimes even worse, it can be used by someone, very powerful government, then mislead the people to a wrong way, even to a war. I give you some example what happened in China. So you talk about, people can speak more, a little more than before. And also we talk about maybe we can think about something, we could talk about something a little bit more, but not other things. For example, if you type in your computer that say, okay, I find some corruption evidence for a local officer. You can tap in the internet, actually. And probably you were bothered by the local government a little bit. But it's okay. Sometimes your information can lead to arrest of the corruption officer. But if you type on the internet that I want to organize a small protest.
Yeah.
Maybe 3 days later on some certain area. First problem you have is you cannot put on the internet. Why? In China, we have a very strict censorship. So many words is forbidden, like democracy. So you cannot put.
So you can't actually put them into the search.
You need to find some way to bypass. So make you if you look at what happened in Chinese internet in the social media, you find many wrong words. Actually, people know what is correct.
Okay.
But correct one cannot. Published.
Okay, Freeman Zhang, thanks very much indeed. We're going to move on to exactly that issue because one of the undoubted opportunities that the internet offers is that of surveillance. Mm-hmm. So what Freeman Zhang was saying is that there are governments in the world and which will use the internet in order to discover dissident activity. In Iran that's happened, in Bahrain, in China. Do you not think that? Given that in those in particular cases, some states have actually used torture, mm-hmm. in those contexts, that you just because they've been able to look at their Facebook page, because there's an openness that you are saying is the right thing to do. I mean, there are huge dangers here, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the ability for governments and police forces to investigate and understand people is far ahead of anywhere it's ever been in the history of mankind. And that's not necessarily a good thing because it isn't always directed at the bad guys. And so I think it's a huge issue. I think that it's tied to the fundamental privacy concerns because we in the Western world buy and use products that completely ignore privacy. And we also allow certain types of things to be made that are either shipped to or copied in China. And we have a whole industry around creating surveillance stuff. Now, I think that on privacy, I'll try to be brief, but I think that the privacy problem that we have today is a lot like climate change or a lot like some of the pollution problems in that we have really screwed ourselves up badly. And that it's going to get much worse before it gets better. Because the thing with any of these things, like spam, remember when we had spam? It got really bad until we almost threw our computers out, but then somehow it healed itself because everybody shouted, we don't want spam anymore. This is going to be a little bit more painful. I think what's going to happen is so the worst thing, I think, including going after the dissidents, is this kind of profiling. So when I'm in the Middle East, I don't want to end up on the no-fly list in America, which is the list that the American airlines have that don't let you fly. And I don't know exactly how I might end up on that list. I might not want to have coffee with this person because they just came from Lebanon. I don't know if they're affiliated. And it is going to cramp my style, and we call this the chilling effect. I may not say certain things on the internet because I don't want to be filtered. And all governments have this history. Even in Japan, depending on what your parents did, your kid may not get a job. Depending on what your parents read, your kid may not get a job. And so if you start to think about all the different profiling that governments are going to do, it's really going to stifle what you say and what you do. And this is a huge cost to democracy because what you need for democracy is the ability to speak up without fear of retribution. And the idea that you may be profiled because of what you say, because you don't know what kind of government is going to be here 2 generations from now. So I think what's going to happen is people are going to start to get profiled. People are going to start to get damaged. Your friends are going to go to jail. And then people are going to speak up and say, we need to deal with this privacy issue. It's going to be a little bit too late because we have so much of that stuff already out there and you can't unpublish stuff. But I think at some point, kind of like spam, we're going to demand this of all of our service providers. It's going to get better.
Okay, let's go to our Pakistan ambassador. She's the journalist Bina Sarwar. Bina, tell us in your experience, since we're talking about authoritarianism and privacy issues, is social media monitored by the Pakistani intelligence?
Well, definitely the Pakistani intelligence has a huge presence on the social media. They've spent I don't know how much money, and they have so many users using multiple IDs to counter those of us who are talking about democracy, human rights, women's rights, and all of that. And that is definitely something that's going on, and there are many of them that are using various other identities which are quite public
That's quite a common strategy, isn't it? To use multiple identities and eggs. And, yeah. and they did that a lot in Bahrain, in the revolution in Bahrain, where you end up with getting people who are activists being trolled by these
people. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, there's a lot of trolling going on. And we see it a lot with people who are talking about peace between India and Pakistan, for example. We get trolled by the Indian extreme right as well as the Pakistani extreme right. And maybe not all of them are intelligence agents, but, you know, there's definitely the extreme right has a huge presence. But on the counter side of that, the internet also has created, you know, bridges for people of India and Pakistan to come together and to be able to develop relationships and friendships despite all of that. And one example is the Aman Ki Asha group on Facebook. And some of the people up there asked me to tell you this and to say how much that has made a difference to how they view people on the other side, India and Pakistan, and not just who are people who are in those countries, but expats in different countries as well.
So you have been monitoring the tweets for us. What else are people saying?
In terms of tweets, there's most people are kind of just retweeting what I've tweeted. And there are some questions.
There's one
good question from a scientist friend in India, near Kolkata. And he says, in response to what Joy had said, he said, how come that's not changing the world so rapidly, or is it causing too rapid a change? That's his question to Joy in response to something that Joy said earlier.
Well, let him answer.
So I think that just fundamentally science and technology has been too focused on making things efficient and faster. And what we really need is science and technology and social media and everything that makes us more natural, more dampening, and all of these things. We have a risk of tremendous fluctuation amplification. That's what's making our world. And so to build resilience, I think, is a new thing. And we haven't been spending enough energy on that, I admit.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the USA, talking to the internet pioneer, Joey Ito. The internet, of course, is about much more than social media and its implications for democracy. It's also fundamentally changing the way we live, making it much easier to buy many things, making it easier to create things, and changing economies throughout the world. In a moment, Joey's going to paint us a picture of the future and how the internet's going to change our lives as consumers. Is that a rosy future? Let's know what you think. Get in touch with us and join the conversation via Facebook at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay or on Twitter at @BBC_WHYS. And here is Joey now to talk to us about the internet and the economic future.
So shifting gears, I think one of the key things that the internet did was it dramatically lowered the cost of communication, collaboration, and distribution. And it's also a philosophy, which is the ability to innovate without asking permission, the ability to hack without asking permission, the ability to connect without asking permission. And what that's done is it's driven down the cost of innovation. Because it used to be that you had to have a tremendous amount of money and a tremendous amount of authority to try out an idea. But Facebook, Yahoo, Google, they all started with small groups of students that had very little money, and they were able to innovate in places that weren't centers of power. So if you extrapolate that, what's happening here at the Media Lab, for instance, is we're working a lot on innovating around things as well. So the manufacturer, 3D printers, laser cutters, we have so many tools to build things at lower and lower costs. And soon we will have this with biotech. And so what's happening right now with the world is that, yes, you can go on Amazon and you can buy things, and we talk about the world being flat. But the flip side of what's happening is, remember when Henry Ford said the Model T, you can have it in any color as long as it's black. So it was a very engineer-driven manufacturing. And then everybody started to create multiple colors. And then it went to customization. And now we have super customization. And now we can actually, downstairs here at the Media Lab, we can build just about anything here. Eventually, I think that everyone will be able to build just about anything they need in their own home. And so it would be personal manufacturing. And then we also have this design. It used to be, like Henry Ford, the engineer designed the thing. And then you have people like Steve Jobs who thought about it from the perspective of the person. And then you have the people telling you kind of what they want. But eventually, I think all of us will become designers, and all of our products that we will create sometime in the future will be fundamentally designed by us. And then it becomes hyper-local. So we may be getting certain parts from China where they're being very efficiently manufactured, but I think fundamentally what's going to happen is companies will still create tools for design, but I think the companies will become platforms where people talk to each other and share ideas. But I think all of us are going to get out of this idea of using mass-produced goods where opening up breaks the warranty. But in fact, we're going to be designing things where all of us are going to be designing our own stuff. And I think that that's going to flip commerce upside down.
Well, that sounds hugely exciting. I can't imagine me designing anything at all. So let's just try and unpack a little bit of what you've just said. I want to focus a little bit on piracy. Mm-hmm. Because it's something that's caused a lot of concern for, I would say, the last 15 to 20 years. It's been a really big issue.
Well, I think the British were pretty afraid of the American literary pirates taking... So it goes back a long way, but anyway...
let's stick to music. this model that we're all familiar with, you know, people buying a CD or an MP3 player, it's becoming more and more of a challenge for companies to sustain. Do you think it's a lost cause?
So if you look at Tecnobrega in Brazil, a lot of the music scenes in Brazil, they've given up selling their MP3s. They actually give it to street vendors on the street because listening to thousands of songs, I used to be a disc jockey, so I know, listening to thousands of songs every month to try to figure out the five that you like, that's actually not fun, it's a chore. But once you figure out the five that all of your friends like, and then they have a concert, you're willing to pull out your wallet and spend a lot of money to get in. So in many of the successful music scenes in Brazil, what they've done is they give the music away, and then they charge a lot at the party, and these musicians and the promoters who are investing are making millions of dollars. And so I think that people are still willing to pay for music, but they're much more interested in the experience, because what's happened is now that music can be transferred electronically for nearly nothing, first of all, the diversity has increased tremendously, and the stars... So back in Madonna, so 2001 was the peak of the hits, and the hits have started to diminish, but... It doesn't make sense that a billion people like the same song. It's only because we had this very constricted access to music. And now what's happening with MP3s is there's an explosion of diversity. And you see independent musicians growing. And I think, for instance, I was talking to a promoter in China. Because of the piracy in China, you find that, and you can tell me if it's true or not, that most of the great music in China are really good singer-songwriters. Unlike in Japan or Taiwan, where they're kind of mass-produced, short-run, good-looking, but not very good musicians. And so I would say that the piracy is actually increasing the quality of many of the musicians and lowering
shifting
the hits.
Creativity.
And the good musicians like Amanda Palmer and others are able to still come up with business models. Now, it's tough for the record companies, but for culture in general, which is what I solve for, is society, I think it's a good thing.
Okay. We haven't been to our Nigerian ambassador yet, but before I do, because I can just see him sitting there, let's just take a couple more questions from the audience. Just raise your hands if anyone wants to say anything. Wait for a microphone, and then the gentleman here in the front.
My name is Chris Peterson. I'm a student here at the Media Lab in the Center for Civic Media, and I just want to ask a quick question on the democracy front, Joey, which I thought you brought a really good point up, which was about voting being a blunt instrument. I was wondering if you could talk about institutions like governments being blunt institutions that may respond differently to blunt mechanisms and sharp mechanisms, and how social media and blunt mechanisms like voting could be complements when most people have thought of them as either being substitutes of each other. Mm.
So can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
So Lawrence Lessig has done a lot of talking and great work around how corruption is now destroying our current form of government. So I think that you should I'll just point at that. There's a very interesting body of work called Liquid Democracy that some people have worked on, and the idea is basically that on every issue you have a vote, but you give it to somebody that you know that knows more about that issue than you. And they give it to the person that they think knows more about it than them, until you end up with two or three experts who then debate it out. You know, and so the idea is that it's a combination of voting and deliberation, but the idea is that you allow the experts to make the decisions rather than the representatives who really don't have the expertise, who are fundamentally driven by direct funds. And so I think there are interesting experiments. I think they're going to happen in local governments. Jim Fiskin at Stanford does this thing called deliberative democracy, where he takes a random sample of the population and has them deliberate for 2 or 3 days. This is a very non-digital thing. But it turns out they can make very sophisticated decisions about things like tax and health care. Really interesting, some local governments in China have asked him to go because they're really interested in experimenting. And I think the local governments, the federal government's going to take a while. I think local governments are going to see a lot of reform because the citizens are really kind of in their face. And I'm quite optimistic on the combination of this deliberation sort of morphing the way we think about voting.
Okay, so you took us back to democracy, but let's just return to this issue of piracy and talk to Aminu Gamawa, our Nigerian Twitter ambassador, who's a student at Harvard. Aminu, are any of the people that are following you saying anything about the piracy issue? Do people think that piracy and file sharing is a threat to the economy, or should we just embrace it?
Well, thank you so much for having me. We have received many tweets from across Africa. One is from South Sudan. Everyone is endorsing and saying that really internet is a good thing, social media is a good thing, and it has changed their life and it has improved their voice in political participation. For example, Chol from Juba, South Sudan, said that the internet has been good for me. It has enabled me to express my democratic rights in my country. And Tufa from Tunisia said that the internet is a double-edged sword. It helped a lot and is still helping nations in their fight for democracy, but at the same time, it is also being used to suppress them. But I also received some skepticism. I had a discussion on Facebook with my friends, and what they are saying is, I'm a big admirer of your work and I'm a big fan of internet. But one thing, if we look at the number of people on Twitter and the number of people on Facebook, and combine them together, they are not up to 20% of the global population. Mm-hmm. So how do you have a good debate, democratic debate, mm-hmm. at the global level when about 80% of the population is excluded? Mm-hmm. That is the first point they make. And the second point, which is I think is also important, even in African countries, you realize that access to internet varies from one part of the country to another. There is a wide gap between the rich and the poor, and wide gap between the people in the rural and the urban area. So when you want to have a democratic process or an economic system mm-hmm. that is based on a tool that is used only by 20% of the population, what is the future? Mm-hmm. So the question now is, how do we democratize access? Mm-hmm. There's no doubt
economic exclusion is a major factor
and
here.
This is a very important focus area for our work. So we've recently gone to East Detroit, into the city, and worked with the local kids there, designing solutions using only local parts and only local ideas. And what's really important, and so for instance, some of our kids just got back from China, from Shenzhen, and they brought back $10 cell phones, you know, and they were saying that these cell phones were sent and were part of the key infrastructure for the Arab Spring, because they were the cheap cell phones that were able to be purchased. And so some people call this frugal engineering. We also call it co-design, which is you can't design solutions for Africa sitting here in Cambridge. You have to go to Africa. And for instance, Tata funds the Media Lab or MIT to send kids to India for 4 months of the year, because you can only design solutions for India in India. And so what I think is going to happen is you're going to find people in the developing world coming up with new ways to do. Power is very important. How do you charge the cell phone if it's 25 cents and you're under the poverty line? There are a lot of issues that we can't even imagine here. But you also have to build them with the parts that are there. You can't build a $20,000 village pump and send it to Africa, because it will never be repaired. So the key thing I think that we need to do right now is to go into the developing world, enable them to start to become innovative. They're already doing it. And it's going to be solutions from China and India and Africa going across these borders, skipping the developed world. And in many cases, kind of like some of these low-cost cars, they will then penetrate the developed world, because the problem is the rich countries don't know how to make low-cost solutions very well. And so I really think, though, that when I'm looking at, like in Nairobi at iHub, I see the kids working on stuff there. I mean, they're brilliant, you know, and we learn so much from them. And so to me, I'm very optimistic because I see innovation hubs in the slums of Bangalore and in all kinds of places. And this is what there's a little trickle down. You may have to go to an internet cafe to read the stuff. But then you can go home and build your own power-generating windmill. And so to me, I think that's where it's going to happen.
I like that, Joe, but I have a quick point that somebody made about the use of internet and the use of cell phones actually to save the lives of women in the rural area. So in Kenya, Nairobi, there's this method of payment that is phone-based. So there are a lot of innovations that have been created around the internet that is really revolutionizing. Social entrepreneurs are using it, and they are using it for good. But another disturbing development also is in places where they are suffering from conflict and violence is extremists and terrorists sometimes use social media to recruit people to do their biddings, and sometimes it creates security problem and security challenges. And then the question now is, how can the government balance between having a free access to internet for everyone and participatory debate, and then having an internet where nobody abuses it to bully anyone or to go into terrorist activities?
So, brief. So, in my experience, at least in the Middle East, is you have really smart young kids who can either become terrorists or entrepreneurs. They're very similar personalities, by the way. And if you give them the opportunity, no, it's true. If you give them the opportunity to become an entrepreneur, either through role models or support, they'll pick entrepreneur. And what I'm very optimistic of, I've only been to North Africa, but even going to North Africa, I see mobs of kids who probably would have gone to extremism jumping on the entrepreneur bandwagon. And so if nothing else, I think entrepreneurship is going to be key in getting the smart kids on the right side of the fight.
Let's see if there are any more questions in the audience. So hands are going up. So the gentleman in the front here. If you can keep it very brief, we've got very little time.
Okay. Without conversation, we don't have democracy. And so what happens, I'm from Taiwan, I'm working at MIT, by the way. And what happens in Taiwan is like every politician have their Facebook page. And, you know, 5% of the comment following any post is curse. And when the clouds is big, there's hater, and hater usually speak loud. So what do you see the next form of social media that support really large communication? Because we really need to debate, we really need to argue, we really need to have conversation to really have democracy.
Okay. Gentleman in front of him.
Hi, my name is Mark Carrere from Boston University School of Education. I wanted to say, you mentioned earlier about the internet being young. What do you think of this idea? I find many solutions in thinking of it as a child. We are a child. Mm-hmm. We're learning to communicate. We send cat pictures. But we're amazingly resourceful. We are creating new music models for businesses, creating ideas that didn't exist. And so I find if we think of us as an internet being, as still a child, that's just starting to learn, starting to communicate. Do you think that could be a useful metaphor?
I think it's exactly the metaphor that I think of. I think we're like a little toddler who can barely walk that's smashing everything in front of itself still, but it has a lot of potential.
I'm really interested in this idea of the community that you talk about that can speak to one another. But what about, you know, that's a virtual community. What about the internet destroying real communities when what you've got on high streets up and down in Western countries just closing down because people are just buying their goods online? They're buying them off Amazon or any other website.
Yeah, so I think it's a phase. You know, first of all, I think it's a phase, and I do think that we are going to become more local again. As I said, I think we're going to see local manufacturing. I do think that certain types of businesses, both local and national, are going to disappear just because the world is changing, like I said, with the music. I mean, we love pyramids, but we can't build them anymore. You know, and so some things that we love are just going to disappear, and it's an unfortunate byproduct.
Let's have some more questions. And then the gentleman over there.
Hello, my name
So you said you provided an economic model for content on the internet. You know, you give freeware and you charge for services, or you know, charge for parties instead of music. But how do you make sure, especially you know, given the news media, the people that are putting pushing content out there, you know, maybe have an agenda. That's why they are providing it for free. So how do you you know, counter that or?
Yeah. So, short answer would be, I think again, it's going to get worse before it gets better. If you look at Kony 2012 or some of these internet memes that have been very well orchestrated by people who are manipulating, and I think that we don't yet have the literacy to really figure it out. I think it's a literacy problem and a structure problem. So, quick answer: it's going to get worse before it gets better. But it's, I think it will, we'll eventually learn how to deal with those things.
Gentleman there.
Hi, my name is Mike Tuyo. I'm a founder of a telecom startup here in Cambridge. I find myself in a small group of people who really don't get the social media, mantra that very well. I got my first email address here at the Media Lab in the 80s, and I've been engaged in on the internet for a long time, but I don't see a lot of quantifiable value in social media. A lot, it seems to be a lot of shouting and very little.
If you could just respond. Sorry, we're so short of time. I want to make sure that you get your voice heard. But Joey, do you want to respond to that?
And I think for a certain generation of people, it may never be that useful. And I think you have to kind of develop a literacy. And some people obviously use it for not very useful things. But I think a good metaphor is it's kind of like you have to turn the radio and find that channel with a signal. And you have to kind of get good at it. I think it's not for everyone, and your mileage may vary.
Okay, one more question here.
Yes, hi. My name is Nabil Alji. I'm an alum of MIT Sloan. And I feel like now we're kind of at the advent of hardware piracy. And there are sites that are sharing now models for, 3D printed objects. And I can see that being a threat to corporations and actually, interestingly, a threat to governments as well, in that, at least in the U.S., there's now 3D printed parts for guns, which are actually illegal, but people are now making in their own homes. And so I'm wondering if you have any advice for corporations and governments with that.
Well, I think it's very similar to the music one in that, yes, if there were a non-broken way of helping, you should. Let's take the gun one off because I think it's a slightly different thing. I think that corporations are going to have to adapt. And all the smart corporations are changing their business models to maybe be distributors of designs or platforms where people share things. But I think that you can't resist this force. It's just happening. And by the way, I love the internet and its philosophy, but I think it's more about preparing yourself for the inevitable and less about everything that's going to happen is good. And so I think that this maker movement and all of this, it feels good to me because it's sort of democratic, but there's going to be a tremendous amount of damage to a tremendous number of companies, and some of them will not survive. And the only advice I would give is to get your head around it now so you can do what you can to prepare.
Joey Ito, thank you very much indeed, and thank you to you all. Do please continue the conversation via Facebook, facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay, or on Twitter at @BBC_WHYS. This has indeed been a fascinating discussion. Thank you all very much indeed at MIT Media Lab for coming. You are listening to the BBC World Service. We've been exploring the impact of the internet on civilization around the world in a special program. What if we could all talk to Joey Ito? Please join me in warm thanks to our hosts here at MIT Lab and fascinating thinker and pioneer, Joey Ito. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.